The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we return to the November 2020 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month has been a mill revival. We've talked about some mills in the pictorial, and we're also working on museums. That's a secondary theme. It says 57 must-see museums. Trust me, we're not going to get to all of them. But we're going to hit just a couple in this short article up front in Raleigh, and you've probably heard of them if you haven't been there yourselves. And under the heading Must Visit Museums, North Carolina's Museum of Natural Sciences and the North Carolina Museum of History. At this pair of museums in downtown Raleigh, history and science come together along three city blocks to tell the story of North Carolina, from its prehistoric past to the people, plants, and animals that call this state home today. The Museum of Natural Sciences introduces as many as 1 million visitors annually to our state's flora, fauna, and fossils, while the Museum of History, through interactive exhibits and artifacts, tells a rich and ever-changing story of its people. If you'd like to visit, the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences is at 1 West Jones Street. Their website is naturalsciences.org. The North Carolina Museum of History is around the corner at 5 East Edenton Street, and they are ncmuseumofhistory.org. Picture here, a whole bunch of prehistoric animals, dinosaur bones and a dinosaur with skin. I don't think they dug them up that way, but they've put something back together the way it must have looked back then. Wouldn't it be fascinating to see one of those in real life? Anyway, Overleaf, Asheville's new aesthetic, reimagined and revitalized the old Asheville Art Museum's stunning new look, anchors the city with its galleries that showcase Western North Carolina's legendary creative achievements, written by Melissa Reardon. For weeks, anticipation heightened around the reopening of the Asheville Art Museum. In the middle of downtown at Pack Square, the temporary fencing around the building was finally coming down after an extensive 2-year renovation. At the unveiling, 1 year ago this month, a striking new landscape emerged. The restored 3-story 1926 Renaissance Revival building, pristine in white Georgia marble, now abuts a perpendicular facade of glass. Above a soaring atrium, the floating SECU, State Employees Credit Union, Collection Hall, juts out from the building's north face, clad in perforated backlit metal with a floor-to-ceiling window, the Oculus, that looks out over the city. It's a captivating sight, especially after the sun goes down, when LED lights shine through the matrix-like pattern, a nod to the ideas of randomness once explored nearby at the trailblazing Black Mountain College. During the day, caught from the right angle, the glass reflects its surroundings, a massive globe installation in the entry courtyard, the towering new Hotel Arras, Biltmore's I.M. Pei designed headquarters, and the Vance Monument, now shrouded in netting as the city planners and artists collaborate on a new inclusive pillar following Black Lives Matter demonstrations. It's a reflective view that speaks to the dynamic changes and explosive growth that Asheville has experienced in recent decades, as well as the museum's new place within that narrative. The reinvigorated 72-year-old institution might be just the city's greatest cultural milestone yet. Within this expansive, reimagined museum, the art offers viewers a look at the important creative contributions born in these mountains, framing them within the larger context of American art from the 20th and 21st centuries, as well as a small holding of relevant works from the late 19th century. This is a place to see sculptures by spruce pine artist Harvey Littleton, who in the early 60s began sculpting glass for a purpose beyond function, and view works by some of the great Black Mountain College alumni, artists, composers, choreographers, and architects who to this day are studied in halls of higher education around the world. The museum offers a chance to witness how contemporary local artists are pushing boundaries, crafting narratives that reveal what it means to be a creator in this time and place. The new modernized Asheville Art Museum serves as an anchor for creativity in this corner of our state, poised to bring far-reaching attention to Western North Carolina's past, present, and future artistic achievements. It's a boon for the city that would not have been possible without enormous community support and visionary direction. Pamela L. Myers, petite, with thick platinum hair and perceptive hazel eyes, strolls through the museum's spacious new Siku collection, surveying the fruits of her 25 years as director. She passes a painting from about 1945 by Zelda Fitzgerald, who lived and died not far away, a wire sculpture by Black Mountain College alumna Ruth Asawa, and renderings from renowned Art Deco architect Douglas Ellington, whose indelible mark graces some of the city's most notable buildings. These and some 5,600 more works comprise the museum's permanent collection. I was really interested in how museums become centers of community and how they engage audiences, Meyer says, reflecting on what drew her away from New York City's famous Guggenheim in 1995, to move to what was then a small bohemian enclave. That interaction sometimes gets lost in bigger metropolitan museums. In Asheville, she saw big potential, the opportunity here in those years to revitalize downtown in terms of art and culture was front of mind for the board leadership of this institution and for some incredible community activists who had a vision for what downtown would become. I felt like I could be part of that. Western North Carolina already had some significant arts achievements to its credit by the time Myers brought her talents to Asheville. Art and craft had been entrenched in the very fiber of southern Appalachia, dating back to the early Cherokee, and Penland School of Craft had been an institution in artistry since the Great Depression, eventually pushing the boundaries of craft well into the realm of high art. The extraordinary legacy of Black Mountain College and its students and faculty, names including Albers de Kooning, Robert Rauschenberg, and John Cage, among others, has had a significant impact on the modern art world since the experimental school's closing in 1957. The area continued to draw first-rate potters, glass blowers, and other skilled artisans who quietly set up studios in the hills and hollows. By the mid-90s, artists were just beginning to coalesce in what would become Asheville's vibrant River Arts District. The chronicle of the art museum is no less storied. It was established by a group of makers in December 1948 and housed in entrepreneur E.W. Grove's land sale office. Over the next four decades, the growing collection of artwork moved from a downtown high-rise to a historic neighborhood home to the basement of the Civic Center complex, where it lived from 1976 until 1992. All the while, the caliber of art and the expectations from both artists and audience grew. By the late 80s, the city had experienced some 60 years of economic depression. Community-wide effort to revitalize downtown resulted in the creation of Pack Place, a city-owned cultural complex at the center of town that encompassed several arts and science nonprofits. Among them, the Art Museum took up residence in the 1926 building that had previously housed the library. Kevin Hogan was among the community of 90s artists and activists who pushed to elevate the arts and later helped establish the River Arts District. He says that the museum's move to Pack Square was key. Leaders in the city and arts community realized if we're going to promote ourselves as an art-making destination, at the very least, we need to do our very best with the museum to put our best foot forward, Hogan says. The new location on Pack Square opened in 1992 and presented a firm foundation on which the museum could grow. But there were structural challenges in both the limited 12,000-square-foot size and the lack of proper climate control. To realize the high-caliber institution that arts and civic leaders envisioned, it would take strong and knowledgeable leadership to see it through. Pam really had a vision for the museum, says ceramist Rob Pullion, who has served on the museum's board for the past 20 years. She wanted a museum that people would come to even if they had never been to a museum before. Under Meyer's leadership, the board strengthened and began to meet the challenges of reaccreditation, the benchmark of a well-run museum. Fundraising commenced and momentum picked up around 2004 when the organization selected New York City-based ENNEAD, Architects, a preeminent firm that has specialized in museums, for the task at hand. Still, to achieve the final outcome, it took another 15 years. Two interim expansions that allowed for formative evaluations, which took over the atrium and a second wing of the disjointed cultural complex. Collaboration between countless local building and mechanical specialists, and a $24 million capital campaign. Last November, when exclusive galas for donors and civic leaders welcomed the first visitors, not a soul was unimpressed. The restored former library building now holds staff offices, the museum's extensive research repository, and educational spaces for meetings and programming. And it's full of art. The Sika Collection Hall, cradled at the building's core, houses curated exhibits from the museum's stockpile. One other wing, spanning three levels, contains two spacious exhibition halls for collaborative and traveling displays, something not previously possible at the current scale, plus auxiliary galleries and expanded state-of-the-art storage. There's even an interactive maker space for the littlest of creators, as well as a rooftop cafe and sculpture terrace. The exhibits, curated by Myers, her team, and sometimes guests, are as innovative and thought-provoking as one expects from a premier art institution. They offer a chance to ponder or simply enjoy the interplay between, say, Andy Warhol's Silver Clouds and Black Mountain College alum Merce Cunningham's 1968 Rainforest video of dancers amid the same metallic floating pillows. Or to consider the parallels between designer Maya Lin's Pin River French Broad River, displayed opposite Wesley Clark's found object sculpture, My Big Black America, one presenting a symbol that connects the region, the other a statement on strife and the unity among black Americans. We have a specific interest in that intersection of the broader development in American aesthetics and the development and contributions of Western North Carolina and the cross-influencing that has happened since the 19th century, Myers said. Looking toward the city's future as a growing cultural mecca, the museum, fittingly, opened with an exhibit that represented the region's present artistic achievements. And putting it together was no small feat. Noted Brooklyn-based guest curator Jason Andrew and staff curators researched more than 700 regional artists, not just considering well-known makers, but also uncovering under-recognized and emerging artists through dozens of studio visits and an open call. The result? Appalachia Now, showcasing 50 contemporary creators from across southern Appalachia, working in diverse disciplines, each piece representing the maker's unique personal, political, or societal perspective from being rooted to the here and now. For visitors, it was a chance to discover the individual experiences that make this part of the world so unique. And for the museum, it was a great place to start a conversation about how the next century of artists from the mountains of North Carolina might continue to shape creative expression in America. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, call the studios, 919-832-5138. And now let's head to Asheville, museum town in the mountains. stroll the grounds of a historic mansion, play pinball, and learn about local culture. With more than a dozen museums, Asheville is a hub of creativity and history. These seven spots help tell the story of the city. There's a beautiful picture here on the main page of Biltmore Estate, and a little arrow pointing to it on the next page over the words Biltmore Estate. A library with 22,000 books, a banquet hall with 70-foot-high ceilings, 35 bedrooms, 43 bathrooms, and 65 fireplaces, a swimming pool and a bowling alley. With more than 4 acres of floor space, Biltmore Estate is, unsurprisingly, the largest private home in the country. Since 1930, when the Vanderbilts opened their home to the public, people have come to Asheville to visit the 250-room French Renaissance Chateau, completed in 1895, and the immaculate gardens designed by famed landscape architect Frederick Law Olmsted. Today, there's also a winery housed in the former dairy barn, 2 inns, and modern shops and restaurants. A self-guided tour of the house covers 3 floors and the basement, each with rooms authentically decorated with antique furniture, vintage clothing, and fine art once belonged to George and Edith Vanderbilt, making it appear as though the couple could walk through the door at any moment. They're at 1 Lodge Street in Asheville, and of course their website is Biltmore.com. Asheville Pinball Museum. Among the bustle of downtown Asheville is a place where people can escape to a simpler time, a time when video games had only joysticks and coin slots, music videos lived exclusively on MTV, and Darth Vader was the most ominous villain around. At the Asheville Pinball Museum, visitors get a chance to dive into the world of video games, arcades, and media from past decades. Star Wars spaceships dangle above eager pinball players in one room. Commercials from the 70s play on a loop next door. And 80s music videos illuminate yet another corner of the museum. Owner T.C. DeBella spent years building his nostalgia-filled collection, and he's found that it's not just the people who grew up with these games that marvel the space. That is the beauty of it. We have visitors as young as 3 years old all the way up to 70-year-olds, and everything in between, he says. It's so cool to see the parents, or even grandparents, show their kids how to play pinball. They're at 1 Battle Square in Asheville. Pinball.ashevillepinball.com. And then we have the Moogseum. That's Moogseum. In 1972, 6 years before Robert Moog moved from Western New York to Western North Carolina, the electronic instrument maker taught a week-long workshop for children in the Clay County community of Brasstown. Under Moog's guidance, the kids built rudimentary synthesizers called Brasstown Bangers. One of those instruments is on display at the Moogseum. The Asheville Museum that celebrates the ideas and eccentricities of one of the most important instrument makers in modern music history. Unveiled in 1964, Moog's synthesizer went on to electronically color the music of artists ranging from classical composer Wendy Carlos, who's switched on Bach, won a Grammy in 1969, to rock and pop acts like the Beatles, Kraftwerk, and Donna Summer. Inside the 1,400-square-foot Moogseum, a timeline follows Moog and his synthesizer, now a staple in all genres of music, from the early years, when he built the prototype, to his later years, living, working, and teaching in Asheville. The prototype sits in the museum alongside a replica of Moog's workbench. A lot of people have a glorified idea of who Bob Moog was, as it's his synthesizer which descended from heaven into a pristine lab where he was wearing a white coat, says Michael Moog-Kusa, his daughter, and the executive director of the Bob Moog Foundation. His real life could not have been further from that. He had struggles, but most of all, he was insatiably curious and interested in teaching all kinds of people. And teach he did. Asheville may be best known for its traditional acoustic music, but Moog showed that the swirling space-age sounds of its synthesizer could fit quite naturally against the mysterious backdrop of the Blue Ridge Mountains. There Center, 50 Broadway Street in Asheville, moogseum.org. The Estes Wynne Antique Car Museum. Originally built in 1923 as Biltmore Industries' weaving shop, this quaint cottage was purchased in 1953 by car enthusiast Harry D. Blomberg. In 1923, Blomberg opened one of Asheville's first filling stations and founded what would become the oldest family-owned car dealership in Asheville. Later, his famous Harry's Motor Inn provided motorists with gas and auto service, as well as a covered place to park for the night. When the weaving shop's previous owners could no longer keep the business afloat, Blomberg purchased it, determined to preserve the historic part of Asheville. When the company downsized, Blomberg filed the weaving shed, or rather filled the weaving shed with his treasured automobile collection, and opened the museum to the public in 1966. The cottage is now home to vehicles like the coveted 1957 Cadillac Eldorado Brougham, a bright red American LaFrance fire truck that had been in Asheville since 1922, and even horse-drawn carriages. They're at 111 Grovewood Road in Asheville. Grovewood.com/antique-car-museum. Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center. Josef and Annie Albers didn't know a word of English when they fled Hitler's Germany and crossed the Atlantic Ocean from North Carolina in 1933. Their destination, Black Mountain College, an experimental school with a short life and a long legacy. Josef became the art teacher while Annie taught a new generation of textile weavers. During the college's 24 years, professors and students broke down hierarchies, toiling shoulder to shoulder on the creation of art and the cultivation of land at a secluded campus in Buncombe County. 6 decades after the school opened, Mary Holden founded a museum to preserve and promote the program's revolutionary spirit. At the renovated 1920s building in downtown Asheville, visitors can step into a gallery lined with works by the likes of painter Robert Rauschenberg and sculptor Ruth Asawa. The wooden loom from Annie's workshop occupies a special place in the museum's collection. They're at 120 College Street in Asheville, blackmountaincollege.org. The Thomas Wolfe Memorial, a giant in both his literary genius and his 6'6" stature, Thomas Wolfe spent his boyhood surrounded by fascinating guests at his mother's boarding house in Asheville. There, the author slept in whatever beds weren't occupied and took mental notes on the characters that would later populate his first novel, Look Homeward, Angel. The thinly veiled autobiography, published in 1929, paints a colorful and scandalous portrait of Wolfe's hometown. Today, his mother's Victorian boarding house, with original stained glass bay windows and some would say ghosts of its former inhabitants, is the centerpiece of the Thomas Wolfe Memorial. Historic site manager Tom Muir calls the 71-year-old museum a front porch to the city. Visitors can take guided tours of the rambling estate built in 1883, including 29 rooms showcasing authentic relics from the hand-painted wooden bed where Wolfe's mother gave birth to all 8 of her children, to ink bottles tossed in the abandoned cistern by guests who valued their written word, much like Wolfe did. No matter where he sat down to write, Muir says, his mind wandered home, and those are the memories he committed to paper. Thomas Wolfe Memorial is at 52 North Market Street, Nashville. Wolfe, with an E, memorial.com. Southern Appalachian Radio Museum. Long before streaming and podcasts, radio dominated the media landscape and paved the way for modern entertainment in North Carolina and beyond. Asheville's Southern Appalachian Radio Museum has preserved more than 100 vintage home and ham radios and even a crank record player for nearly 20 years. Each machine had a story to tell, from helping save lives on sinking ships to the early stages of messaging through Morse code. The radios found in this museum have played an integral role in many historic events. The goal of the museum, though, is to show how modern technological advances like GPS and even cell phones wouldn't be possible without these pioneering radios. Asheville Buncombe Technical Community College, Elm Building in Asheville, avlradiomuseum.org. And Overleaf, we have one more, the Bascom, it says. It's hard to imagine that the Bascom was born some 37 years ago as a two-room exhibit space at the Hudson Library, a mile down Highlands Main Street from its current location. Today, the 11-year-old six-acre visual arts campus comprises ceramic studios, nature trails, and a sprawling three-story main building that serves as a gallery and event space. The historic building's weathered rustic exteriors belie the beauty found inside, from ceramics fired at the Dave Drake Studio Barn, a refitted riding stable from when the property was a horse farm, to rotating exhibits displayed in spaces as beautiful as the works hanging on the walls. So that's the end of that article. We just have, 2 minutes left. What can we find to read for 2 minutes? Well, let's tell you what we're going to do. At the front of the magazine, they have one, two, or three double-page pictures each month. It's called A View from Here, and we'll plow our way through them. Over the river and through the woods, Linville Falls. Driving across the Linville River on the Blue Ridge Parkway, you're not likely to notice the elaborate stone arches of the 1940 Linville River Bridge beneath you. But stop in the parking lot at milepost 316.5, and a short trail will lead you to the river's edge and a more complete view of one of the parkway's longest, stone bridges. This is a really nice-looking bridge from the side. There's fall trees, in all the fall colors, that is, on either side of a river, which has a lot of rocks in it. It's not navigable. And there's a bridge, two-lane roadway, with a lot of gray stacked stone forming the archways. There's two archways. I can't tell whether water runs over the second archway. Maybe it did at the time they built it. But there's two archways, and a car is going over the top. In Overleaf, we have, it says, as we list all the things we're thankful for this year, it's a funny year to think about that, isn't it? We'll count green beans, mashed potatoes, turkey, dressing, and cranberry sauce among them. So naturally, on this page, we have close-ups of green beans. Look like they have maybe a little bit of slivered almonds in that bowl. And then there's some mashed potatoes, the kind that still has a little bit of the skin in there, and I do like it that way. And then there's a bowl of gravy right next to that. And here's all that stuffing with all those good things thrown in it. And in the bottom right, a nice bowl of whole berry cranberry sauce, just the way I like it. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine, and I hope you enjoyed it so much that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the good old Carter Glass Insurance Agency, which has underwritten us for so many years and been in the community since 1974. You can trust them. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.